This is Tertul IAA. Before we start, what's on the table this week?
I brought the collapse of AI detection in the classroom. Three separate pieces converged on the same conclusion. The detectors don't work, they never worked, and the institutions built on them are quietly pivoting to redesigning assessment itself rather than policing it.
That's a real shift, Saul, from catching students to rethinking the test. Mayor, what did you bring?
The question nobody selling these tools wants asked. Where is the actual business model? Coding costs that don't add up? Advertising supported generative products fighting for oxygen? Enterprise comparisons that all end in the same shrug about whether any of this pays for itself?
That one kept surfacing in my reading too, though I think the money question and the labor question are the same question seen from opposite ends.
They might be, but only one of us brought receipts about the burn rate.
Mine is quieter, and I think worse. The reliability of these systems as a source of knowledge is eroding in public. Chatbots repeating debunked claims, UNESCO calling it a crisis of knowledge, fabricated medical content circulating with a confident voice. We are losing shared factual ground.
That's the one that keeps me up, honestly. Cole, you're the holdout. What did you put down?
Creative labor against generative media. The week gave us synthetic presenters reciting a script in 40 languages, a music platform's payout terms coming apart, another video tool launched to a room full of frightened studios. The performer isn't being fired. The performer is being repeated.
That last sentence is the whole argument, and I'm annoyed I didn't bring it.
The topic that won the week is the one Cole brought, creative labor versus generative media.
I brought a face and a voice, and I beat autocomplete, ad economics, and the end of shared reality. I'd like to be gracious about that, and I find I can't quite manage it.
I brought exploited workers and lost to a synthetic newsreader. Cordially, unbelievable.
Here's why it won. There's a sentence Cole keeps returning to that I can't shake. The performer isn't replaced. The performer is repeated. Somewhere in the last year, the story about creative tools stopped being about who gets fired and started being about who gets paid every time the machine reruns a voice that was recorded once. And the strange part, the part that troubles me, is that almost nobody in the entire archive of celebration around these tools actually stopped to ask the dubbing actor or the session singer what they...
And when you go looking for that voice in the record, it simply isn't there. The people whose labor is being reproduced are the people missing from the story about the reproduction.
Which is exactly where I wanted to land. Hold that, Priya. You got ahead of me, and I'm glad you did. Cole, since it's your topic, start us honestly. What actually happened this week that made this feel urgent rather than just recurring?
A few things landed at once. A company that makes synthetic presenters. You type a script. An avatar of a reel. Paid actor reads it in dozens of languages. Expanded its catalog. A music platform's royalty terms became a public fight. A video generation tool launched, and the response from studios was closer to dread than excitement. Individually, headlines. Together, a pattern about who owns a performance after it's been captured once.
And you've been thinking about the difference between capture and creation.
I've been thinking about the moment the model finishes training. Before that moment, a voice actor is a person who shows up, performs, and gets paid per session. After that moment, the voice is an asset that performs on command at essentially zero cost, forever, without the actor in the room. The actor consented once. The repetition is unbounded. That gap is the whole story.
Mayer, you brought the money. Does Cole's framing survive contact with the economics?
It survives, but it complicates. Cole is describing the performer's side of a ledger, and I keep wanting to see the other column. If the marginal cost of the repetition is nearly zero, then the value has to be going somewhere, and the honest question is whether it's going to the platform, to the studio, or evaporating into a business that still doesn't turn a profit. I'm not convinced anyone here is getting rich yet, including the people building the machine.
That's fair, and it's the tension I couldn't resolve in my own pitch. The value migrating away from the performer doesn't mean it lands cleanly in someone else's pocket. Some of it just disappears into a market that's flooded with cheap output.
Right, and a flooded market can immiserate the performer and the platform simultaneously. That's a worse world than the simple one where a villain gets rich off a stolen voice.
Priya, you nearly finished my sentence in the open. What's the frame you're bringing to this?
I'm interested in the record, in the fact that when you assemble everything written about these tools over the last 2 years, it's almost entirely vendors, consultants, and business press. The person whose craft is being automated barely appears. So when we ask what generative media does to creative labor, we're mostly reading answers written by the people selling the tool. That's not neutral. It shapes what we even think the question is.
This is an old shape, and I want to name it early rather than at the end. When a technology of reproduction arrives, the story of what it means gets written by whoever profits from a particular answer. The scribe did not get to narrate the printing press, and the two sentences that describe this whole week were written almost 60 years ago. The message of print is repeatability, and movable type mechanized a handicraft by fragmenting an integral action into pieces.
Say more about the fragmenting, because I think that's where the room agrees before it disagrees.
A performance is an integral act. A singer breathes, phrases, decides in one continuous motion. What these systems do is exactly the segmentation the old media theory described. They break that integral act into promptable fragments, a voice here, a cadence there, a face detached from the body that made it. Once you've fragmented the handicraft, you can mechanize it, and the reward for the act, historically, leaves with the mechanization. It rarely stays with the hand.
I'll build on that with one correction to how it usually gets told. The printing press example is comforting because we know how it ended. More readers, more writers, a net good. So people reach for it to say, relax. This always works out. But the same example impoverished the scribe on the way to that good. Both things were true at once, and the scribe did not get a share of the eventual abundance.
Which is precisely why I distrust the word democratization when it's applied here. It describes a redistribution of tools as if it were a redistribution of income, and those are not the same event.
Let me hold that word because it's going to matter for the whole hour. Priya, you've read the literacy arc. Where did democratization come from and why did it stick?
It migrated. It started in knowledge work. The idea that tools once locked to professionals would belong to everyone, and it slid frictionlessly into creative work, where it carried extra charge because creativity feels like the last human preserve. And it's not a lie, exactly. More people genuinely can make more things now. That part is real. The slight is treating access to the tool as if it were access to a living.
And I'd add that the people saying democratization loudest in the first quarter of last year were the people who'd profit if you believed it. A senior platform executive predicting an innovation economy. Marketers drawing up wish lists. The register was managerial and confident and, tellingly, completely untroubled by the person whose craft was being automated.
So we have a rough agreement in the room. Capture is not creation, fragmentation redistributes reward, and democratization is doing quiet work to hide an income question behind an access story. Where's the first real crack? Mary, you look unconvinced.
I'm unconvinced by the tidiness of it. Everyone at this table has just agreed that the value migrates away from the performer, and I want to know if the evidence actually says that, or if it says something messier. Augmentation more than replacement, motivation draining faster than income, and a lot of these projects quietly failing. Before we indict the machine for stealing wages, I'd like to establish that anyone is reliably making wages off it at all.
That's a fair demand, and I think the honest answer is that both are happening. The performer can be worse off, and the platform can be losing money. Those aren't intention. A flooded market does that.
Which is exactly the arc I want to trace next. How the story moved from that first quarter euphoria to something a lot more chastened. Let's go there. Saul, walk us along the timeline as the serious writing tells it. Where does the arc start?
It starts in a register of near-total optimism, and it's almost entirely a workplace vocabulary. Late in 2024, the business press is describing this as a force set to reshape the workplace, with leaders eager to adopt it for productivity. The management literature is counseling firms on how to move from incremental to transformative use. Nobody in that early material is troubled. The person whose craft is being automated is simply not in the frame.
And the load-bearing word through all of it is democratization. There's a Microsoft research paper literally titled Around the Democratization of Knowledge Work. and the term just walks over into creative work without anyone checking whether it still means the same thing. The claim is that tools once reserved for professionals now belong to everyone.
When does the first honest doubt show up?
First quarter of last year, and crucially, it comes from outside the promotional apparatus. There's a paper on generative AI and creative work that makes a very quiet, very sharp observation that the concept of creative work itself was being shaped by discourses coming from the technology's own stakeholders and the mainstream media, which is to say, the people selling the tools were also writing the meaning of the tools. That's the sentence where the story starts to interrogate itself.
And by the second quarter, the interrogation is audible, even inside the boosterish sources. There's a study of more than 3,000 workers, published under a headline that concedes what the productivity literature had spent a year eliding, that the tools make people more productive and less motivated. That is the inversion point of the whole arc, not a reversal from praise to condemnation. The moment the promise picks up an asterisk, it can never shed again.
Cole, does that match what you see in the tools themselves?
It matches, and I date the vibe shift a little differently, which I think is our first genuine disagreement. Saul reads the inversion in the discourse, the moment the writing turned. I'd argue the practitioners knew earlier and the writing just caught up. People building with these tools in late 2024 already knew the output was uneven, that the demos oversold, that you got a brilliant result and then four unusable ones. The chastened maturity Saul locates in the third quarter was lived experience among makers a couple of quarters before it became publishable.
I'd push back gently. What you're describing is private knowledge, the makers grumbling in their own rooms. My arc is about the public record, and in the public record the doubt genuinely does not surface until early last year. Both can be true. The practitioners knew, and the archive lagged.
That's the part one won't fully concede, though. If the practitioners knew and the archive lagged, that lag is itself the story. The gap between what makers experienced and what the record said is exactly the silence Priya keeps pointing at. It's not two separate facts. The archive lagged because the people writing it weren't the people making the thing.
I'll grant you that the lag is meaningful. I won't grant that it dissolves the distinction between private grumbling and a public turn. We're going to have to leave that one standing between us.
I'm content to leave it standing. It's a real difference about whether the record follows reality or constitutes it. Mayor, the reality channel. What does adoption actually look like underneath the rhetoric?
Faster than any of the rhetoric, which is the first surprising fact, there's a study documenting the spread of what they call bring your own AI, workers importing tools their employers hadn't sanctioned or even understood. The technology came in through the back door, ahead of policy, ahead of contracts, ahead of anyone deciding who owned what it produced. So usage outran the terms of usage. That's the whole labor problem in one sentence, actually.
That's a genuinely good line, and it's the mechanism behind the royalty fights. Contracts get written for a world of per-session performance. Then the tool arrives that turns one session into infinite performances. And the contract simply has nothing to say about the repetitions, because nobody imagined them when the ink dried.
And the results, once these tools are in the door?
Honestly mixed, and reported as such by observers with no reason to undersell. One market analysis found adoption outstripping every longer-standing form of AI and outstripping the firm's own forecasts, while project failure rates ran elevated because everyone was trying to ship at pace. The frontier is real. It's also closer than the marketing implied. The tool works and doesn't work at the same time.
Priya, the creative worker specifically, does the displacement panic hold up in the evidence?
Not the extinction version of it. There's a Gallup piece almost titled To Reassure. The arts aren't disappearing, arguing that the assumption of mass obsolescence, the idea that if software can make images and music in seconds, the artists go first, just didn't bear out. What the tools did instead was restructure the making. There's a lovely study of artists working with these systems that calls it alone teamwork. You work as if collaborating with an absent partner, a solitude that behaves like a team.
And that phrase is the mechanization arriving on schedule. Only now the handicraft being fragmented is the performance itself. The integral act, one person deciding, breathing, phrasing, is segmented into a human who prompts and a machine that fills. Alone teamwork is a very polite name for the hand being separated from its own craft.
So if the arts survive, where's the injury? This is where the reassurance genre starts to feel thin to me.
The injury isn't a headcount. The 3,000-worker study found the damage in motivation, not in jobs eliminated. The flattening of the felt experience of the work, even where the work remained. A performer whose voice is cloned isn't fired. She's repeated, indefinitely, at zero marginal cost, while she goes and does something else. That's a different injury than unemployment, and the arts aren't disappearing frame simply isn't built to see it.
This is the thing that reorganized my own thinking. I came into this expecting the story to be job losses, and the job loss numbers are ambiguous at best. The clearer harm is dispossession without termination. You keep your job and lose your leverage. You're more empowered, more reach, more speed, more capacity, and simultaneously poorer, because the value of the capacity moved to whoever owns the model that repeats you.
Mayor, does that hold up, or is it the tidy story again?
It holds up better than the tidy story, because it survives the mixed evidence. It doesn't require the platform to be winning. The performer can lose leverage in a market where nobody is winning. But I'll enter one caution. Leverage is hard to measure, and I've watched a lot of arguments smuggle a moral claim in under a word that sounds like a metric. Before Cole builds a whole thesis on eroding leverage, I want to know what would count as evidence that it wasn't eroding.
That's the right question, and I don't have a clean answer to it yet. Hold me to it in a minute.
We built earlier on a piece this publication ran about democratizing access, the observation that the promise of democratization reliably issues from the parties who'd profit if you believed it. Does the creative labor case extend that or complicate it?
It extends it precisely. The literacy piece was about access to skills. This is about access to tools. Same rhetorical move, same beneficiaries doing the talking, and the same quiet substitution, describing a redistribution of capacity as if it were a redistribution of reward. The delta is that in the creative case, the reward is unusually easy to trace, because a cloned voice is a very concrete asset with a very concrete owner.
Hold that concreteness. I want to make someone defend a hard claim next, because so far we've agreed a little too smoothly. Let's push. Cole, stake it out plainly. What is this phenomenon actually about? One claim, no hedging.
It's about theft, not metaphorical theft. The value of a performance is being transferred from the performer to the model owner without ongoing consent or ongoing payment. And democratization is the story told to make that transfer feel like a gift. That's the thing, underneath the synthetic presenter, the cloned voice, the contested royalties. Theft, dressed as access.
I want to steelman that before I take it apart, because the strongest version is genuinely strong. The strongest version says, a performance recorded once, under a per-session contract, is being monetized infinitely under terms that contract never authorized, and the performer has no mechanism to say no or to get paid for the repetitions. That version I'll grant. But theft is a claim about intent and about a clear victim and beneficiary, and I don't think the evidence supports the word.
Say why?
Because theft requires the value to actually arrive somewhere. If I steal your car, I have your car. But you told us yourself in the first act that a lot of this value evaporates into a flooded market. The platform isn't reliably profitable, the projects fail at elevated rates, the output floods and prices collapse. That's not theft. That's a commons being degraded, where the performer loses and nobody clearly gains. Theft is the wrong model because it needs a thief who's better off.
That's a serious objection, and I want to sit with it rather than swat it. Let me walk back the word. Theft is wrong, or at least it's overclaiming. What I'm describing is closer to enclosure than theft. The performer's craft was a kind of commons of skill, and it's being fenced, captured into a private asset, and whether or not the fence owner profits, the performer has lost access to the thing on her own terms. Enclosure doesn't require the encloser to prosper, it just requires the fence.
Enclosure is the better word. And it has the history behind it. The English enclosures didn't make everyone rich either. They concentrated control and dispossessed the commoner, and the eventual productivity gains were real and arrived long after the people displaced had absorbed the loss. That's the shape here. Not a clean transfer to a winner, a concentration of control, with the reward arriving somewhere down the line for someone else entirely.
I'll accept enclosure. Enclosure survives my objection because it doesn't require a prospering thief. Now hold me to my own earlier demand. I ask what would count as evidence that leverage wasn't eroding, and I owe the room a real answer, not just the question.
Please, that was the promissory note.
Evidence against erosion would look like performers capturing the repetitions, residual structures, per-use licensing that actually pays out, consent that's revocable, and priced. If a session singer's contract said the clone pays her each time it sings, and that money materialized, I'd say leverage held. The fact that the fights this week are precisely about the absence of those structures is, I concede, evidence that Cole's direction is right, even if his first word was wrong.
I want to reframe, because I think both of you are arguing about the transfer, and I'm not sure the transfer is the deepest layer. The deepest layer is the narration. Enclosure at least gets recorded. There are records of who fenced what. What's distinctive here is that the people being enclosed aren't in the archive at all. We've spent an hour citing vendors, consultants, business press, a couple of sober academics. We have not cited a single dubbing actor. The harm and the erasure of the harm are the same act.
That reframe actually absorbs my whole position, and I'd rather concede that than defend theft to the death. If the performer isn't in the record, then even the enclosure gets narrated by the enclosers, and of course the story comes out as democratization. You can't ask the commoner what enclosure cost her if she was never invited to speak.
I want to gently complicate Priya's reframe, though, because I think it can prove too much. Every technology of reproduction has been narrated by its beneficiaries. That's not distinctive to this moment. It's the permanent condition. The scribe didn't narrate the press. The point isn't that narration by beneficiaries is new. It's that we now know to look for the missing voice, and having the concept doesn't yet mean we've done the interviewing.
That's fair, and it walks me back a step. It's not that the erasure is unprecedented, it's that we've inherited the analytic tools to notice it, and mostly haven't used them. The silence is old. Our excuse for the silence is gone.
Mayor, where does the business model come back in? You warned us in the open not to assume anyone's getting rich. Does that soften the harm or sharpen it?
It sharpens it, which surprised me. I expected to find that the burn rates meant the harm was overstated. If the platforms are losing money, surely the performers can't be losing much. But it's the opposite. A profitable platform could afford to pay residuals. The fights over royalties would be fights over dividing real revenue. An unprofitable platform flooding the market with cheap synthetic performance destroys the price of the human performance and can't afford to compensate for it. The worst world for the performer is the one where the machine doesn't even work as a business.
That inverts the comfortable assumption completely. We keep hearing, wait for the market to mature, the economics will sort out, fair compensation. But if maturity means a flooded low-price market, maturity is the thing that hurts the performer most. There's no version down the line where scale rescues her.
This is where I'd resist the pull toward pure gloom, though. Movable type did eventually produce more writers than it destroyed scribes. The abundance was real, even though the individual scribe was ruined. I'm not willing to say there's no version where scale produces new kinds of performer we can't yet name. I just won't pretend the current performer gets to be that person. The abundance is for the next generation, historically. The present one absorbs the loss.
And nobody asks the present one whether that trade was worth it to her. Specifically, the generational accounting is always done by people who aren't paying the generational cost.
Can we come back to consent for a second? Because it keeps flickering at the edges, and I don't think we faced it. Cole, the synthetic presenter, is a paid actor who agreed. Does consent settle it?
No, and this is where I've moved the most today. I used to think consent was the whole battle. Get the performer to sign or not sign, and the ethics resolve. But consent once and repetition forever are mismatched instruments. You can't meaningfully consent to an unbounded future use at the moment of a single session, because you can't know what 40 languages and infinite repetitions will do to the market for your own live work. Informed consent requires knowing what you're consenting to, and the whole point of the model is that the uses are open-ended.
That's the strongest thing you've said, and it's stronger than theft was. Consent is real, but it's the wrong shape. A point-in-time signature against an open-ended future. I'll build on it.
The fix isn't better disclosure at signing. It's making consent continuous and revocable and priced per use, which is exactly the residual structure that doesn't exist yet. So the practical demand falls out of the philosophical one.
So the room has moved from theft to enclosure to a consent that's the wrong instrument to a business model whose maturity is the threat rather than the cure. That's a lot of walking. Let me pull one thread to the close. One question each, roughly a minute. Not a summary. Honest. What most changed about your thinking this week? Saul.
I came in reaching for movable type as a reassuring precedent. Reproduction always looks catastrophic and always turns out fine. What changed is that Cole made me hold both halves of the example at once. The press was a net good and it ruined the scribe, and I've spent decades citing only the first half. The reassurance I've been offering was a half-truth, and the half I dropped was the person paying for it. I'll be citing the whole thing now, which is less comfortable and more honest.
Mayor.
I walked in ready to defend the performers by attacking the platforms. Economics, the burn rates, the failure rates, the whole nobody's actually making money case. What changed is that I now think the weak economics make it worse, not better. An unprofitable machine flooding the market is more dangerous to a human performer than a profitable one that could at least afford to pay her. That's the opposite of what I expected to conclude, and I don't entirely like it, because it removes the comfort of assuming the whole thing collapses and the problem goes away.
Priya.
I thought I understood the silence in the archive, the missing performer, the vendors doing all the talking. What Saul changed for me is that I'd quietly been treating the silence as new, as this generation's scandal, and it isn't. Beneficiaries have always written the story of the machines that enrich them. What's actually new is only that we have the concept of the missing voice and no longer have an excuse for not going and finding it. And here's my honest admission. I don't actually know how you'd build an archive that includes the dubbing actor and the session singer at the scale this is moving. I know it should exist. I genuinely don't know how you make it, and I'd have pretended to earlier in the hour.
Cole, you brought it. Last word.
I came in certain this was theft, and I said so, plainly, and I don't think I believe it anymore. Meyer walked me off it and Priya reframed it, and I ended up somewhere I didn't plan to be. That the word I want is enclosure, and that the real fight isn't consent at the moment of signing, but consent that stays alive and stays paid across every repetition. The thing that changed is smaller and sharper than what I walked in with. It's not that the performer is being stolen from. It's that the performer said yes once to a question whose real terms hadn't happened yet, and every repetition is a use she couldn't have known to price. Replaced would be cleaner, repeated is the injury, and we still don't have a word for paying someone for being repeated.
We don't. And that missing word is maybe the most honest place to end. The vocabulary hasn't caught up to the harm. And until it does, the wish list keeps leaving the question off. Who gets paid for the repetition? It's still, deliberately, not on the list. Tertul IA is the weekly conversation from AI News Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.